I think there is something to be said about individuals taking ownership of their own personal security that then has an impact in what they do in their workplace. It's all about kind of just thinking about it, right? Just taking a minute to just stop and think about it. Is this the right decision? Am I making the right choice?
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where we break down the most interesting stories in the field with help from our panel of experts. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and joining me today, Dave Bales of X-Force Incident Command and host of the Not the Situation Room podcast, Michelle Alvarez, manager, X-Force Strategic Threat Analysis, and the illustrious Brian Clark, senior technology advocate and a producer on this very show, stepping in front of the camera. Here is what we're talking about today. Developers keep leaving secrets out in the open. 200 companies were hit in the Gainsight breach, the Android streaming device that comes pre-hacked, and how poetry can defeat your AI guardrails. Plus, stick around at the end for a sneak peek of our newest bonus episode, where a malware reverse engineer tells us what it's like to discover a new strain of malware. But first, the return of Shai Hulud. The Shai Hulud worm first ripped through NPM packages in September, and now a new strain, dubbed Shai Hulud, but the I is a one this time, it's very confusing, is causing even more chaos in the NPM registry. It has even started infecting packages in Maven, too. Like its predecessor, it's a worm that steals developer secrets and spreads by publishing malicious packages under its victims' account names, so they look very legitimate. Hundreds of NPM packages have been trojanized by the worm thus far, including packages from trusted entities like Zapier and Postman. Shai Hulud Round 2 also comes with some notable upgrades, including it now executes during the pre-install phase, which helps it evade some detection. It has self-healing capabilities, and if it doesn't find any secrets on your machine, it just tries to delete the entire home directory. Now, Dave, I know you folks have covered Shai Hulud on your podcast, starting with the original worm back in September, so I want to throw to you first. What are your thoughts on this new round, especially compared to the last time we saw Shai Hulud? What's changed?
It's automated now. It's completely automated. It spreads automatically. It installs automatically. There's no interaction that's needed between the user and the machine. And like you said, it will wipe out your home directory, which the original Shai Hulud would not do. So it's got some upgraded capabilities, and it's infected, more than 25,000 repositories at this point, which was larger than the first iteration of Shai Hulud. So it's growing up. It's, you know, it's no longer a toddler. It's now a petulant little teenager.
And what do you think of that choice to make it a wiper if things don't go the way they want it to go, right? Like, what do you think the game, is it just like throwing a tantrum, basically?
It's exactly what it is. I can't find the cookies, so I'm going to lay down on the floor kicking and screaming. It's basically what it's doing.
Michelle, I want to ask you if this pattern of kind of, you know, a malware that when it doesn't find what it wants, it throws a tantrum and tries to blow things up. Is this common? Have we seen this kind of thing before? You know, what's your take on it?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm the right person to necessarily ask if this is a pattern or something that we're seeing increasing across various client environments. But I do want to say that Shai Hulud, it's not an enigma in terms of like things that we're seeing in the environments. We definitely are seeing this active, and it's a concern for our clients right now, especially since we had round one, and round two is significantly worse. So, you know, in terms of the broader picture, though, I think what we are concerned about also is possibly the loss of trust with these open source platforms. We want to be able to leverage them and use them, and they've done a lot of good in terms of being open source for the community and innovation and automation. But then when we have these supply chain attacks right? Now we're looking at, okay, what's the bigger picture? Is there more risk to using these types of platforms?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And we talked last week about kind of open source approaches to security, right? We were talking specifically about the X-Force releasing a bunch of new tools to open source on GitHub. And it is this tricky line you have to walk when you go open source with anything, right? Where, like you said, it's done a lot of good for the community, but it is also like part of your attack surface, and it extends your attack surface even beyond the confines of your own organization. Brian, any thoughts on that? The kind of dance of open source, keeping it secure, putting things out there. What's your take?
I think we're always going to have that like thin line between, you know, everybody wanting things to be open source and accessible, and then also at the same time sort of backpedaling or double checking what we're putting out there or what we're bringing onto our own machines. I guess like my first takeaway, I'm just still so stuck on the name, the Second Coming, and wondering if this is going to be part of a trilogy maybe. It's safe to say at this point that they're Dune fans. We know that. I did find it interesting that it uses Trufflehog to scan for the tokens on the local machine. And then also just the thoughts about, well, what do we do if this happens or if we're affected? I was reading a little bit about how rotating your credentials or scanning your endpoints, but it's a scary thing. Like Dave and you were talking about a minute ago, throwing a tantrum, just, okay, I don't get what I want, so nobody wins.
So this whole thing places the focus yet again on the kind of vulnerabilities of the software supply chain, right, as like a primary target for attackers. And it's got me thinking, you know, have developers kind of become the front line in our you know, defense systems right now? You know, we talk a lot about your everyday employee being the front line. They get a phishing email, they got to stop it. But what about developers too? Are they on the front line now? And are we doing enough to support them? Dave, I'll start with you. Any takes there?
I think the developers are actually becoming the targets more so than the front line of defense. Developers are extremely sensitive to their code. They like their code being their own. And when their code gets obfuscated with something else, they take great offense to that. Problem is that they're not always aware that their code is being stolen from them and then turned into something malicious. And then they find that out later, and now they don't know what to do. They have to go back into their code. They've got to fix their code, republish their code. The most important key to that, though, is that they have to reestablish the trust that they've been given by the people who use their code. That's not always easy to do.
That's a very good point, right? How do you reestablish that trust? And it's almost like it makes the tail of the attack, its blast radius, even bigger. Because now it's not just your package got hit and you got to fix that package. It's like you said, Dave, now how do you get people to trust that the rest of your packages aren't also malicious?
My package is good now. Yeah, you know, my package is fixed. It's fixed, I promise. And they can say that all they want. But, you know, as a user of some of these NPMs, I'm not going to trust it until I've seen someone else, you know, dip their toe in the water.
Something like the Shai-Hulud, where the way it spreads is by publishing malicious packages under your name, right? And so, I don't know, I can imagine a situation where I'm a developer, I don't even know one of my packages has been hit with this thing. And all of a sudden, people are telling me that I'm spreading malware. I'm like, what the heck happened here? So if developers are becoming a target, not just the front line, which I think is a very important distinction, what are some of the things our organizations have to kind of start doing to help strengthen the defenses around this particular target? Michelle, any thoughts there on your end? What can we start doing?
Yeah, I feel like we're always iterating this, which is, you know, user education and user enablement and training. You know, it could be a tack that we're not aware of, but now we are, right? So are we now integrating that in our user training and awareness programs? Because we've had so many of similar types of attacks. I really think this is something we're going to see into the foreseeable future as more and more of these types of packages are basically modified for malicious purposes. And we have this domino effect of, again, you know, one library now cascading to multiple projects and infecting multiple organizations. And it is a brand reputation issue, as Dave alluded to. Right now, this is my brand. This is my name. Now it's got a black mark on it.
Absolutely. Brian, any final thoughts here to round out the segment?
I would just say that for developers and security experts to sort of work together, making sure that I know developers are usually working on what gets the product or whatever they're working on out the quickest and most efficiently, where security experts are what is going to get it done safely. So those two working together and security experts not necessarily saying, no, you can't do that, but let's work together and get that done in a safe manner. So I guess security experts thinking like developers, developers thinking like security experts, and just sort of bridging the gap there.
I like that. You've kind of tapped one of the running themes of the show, which is that security kind of has to not always be saying no, but saying, here's how we do it safely, right? Now, let's move on to a story where developers are still the target, but this time they might be doing some things to make themselves the target. This is some research from Watchtower that found that developers keep leaking secrets to code formatting tools. Now, offensive security researchers at Watchtower Labs analyzed some publicly accessible URLs on the popular code formatting tools JSON Formatter and Code Beautify, and found 80,000 plus saved JSON blobs, which included such treasures as SSH keys, Active Directory credentials, and even some customer PII. The researchers decided to plant some of their own fake tokens that they could track to see if there was anybody exploiting this weakness. And spoiler alert, of course, there were. They found people taking their fake tokens and trying to use them just, I think, within 48 hours of putting them out there. So, you know, there are some malicious entities who are aware of this vulnerability. I want to start by asking the question of why are people so willing to paste confidential code and data into a public tool with unproven security controls? Brian, you left, which means I'm going to throw it to you first. What are your thoughts here?
It's quick and easy. I feel like as human beings, we are simple creatures. It's a quick and easy thing. I don't necessarily, I guess, understand like the formatting. I know there was a lot in the article talking about like beautifying the code, prettifying the code. But at the end of the day, that tool does what people are looking for it to do quickly and easily. So of course it's going to be a perfect place to set up an attack.
I'm wondering though, if these tools have any kind of responsibility to shore up their defenses. I want to ask you, Dave, do you think that this is something that we can put some of the blame on the tool's feet, or is it really just like, developers, stop doing this? What are your thoughts?
No, I think you can always put some of the blame on the tool's feet. I mean, it's not always the developers. And we do have a bad habit of blaming developers when something goes wrong. And, you know, damaging the reputation, like we talked about a few minutes ago. You can't always look at the developer and say, hey, I know what you're doing here. You're sending out the tool is just making it pretty. It doesn't work that way. There's some blame to go around. It's not one person. It's not one tool. It's both. They have to be able to work together. You've got to be able to work with your machinery in order to create the cog.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it can come down to just as simple as an SOP, right? What is your process and procedure say? When you're developing code, what are the tools you're able to use? And if you're able to use those tools, what types of data are you able to include on those platforms? And it, you know, maybe 9 times out of 10, I'm just throwing out a statistic I'm not really necessarily confident in, but you know, maybe it's just as simple as that. What does your SOP say about how you develop and share code, and what are those specific data sets that you're able to do on those platforms? And it may be as simple as that. I mean, there may be more complexity to it, but sometimes that's all it is.
Absolutely. And I think it does start to raise too, though, you know, there's always this kind of, I don't know, call it a phantom issue of shadow IT, right? You can tell people what they are or aren't allowed to use. Some people don't always listen, right? And I think especially in kind of like an AI era, we're seeing a lot more shadow IT and shadow AI kind of pop up. And so I'm wondering, right, you know, you can set some rules around what people can or can't use, but there's always going to be people who maybe skirt the rules or whatever. I don't know. Is there anything you can do about that? Or is shadow IT just something we're destined to deal with? And I'm going to throw it to you, Dave, actually. I want to see if you have some thoughts here.
I feel attacked here.
I just feel like you're the guy most likely to have some ideas about shadow IT, you know?
You know, shadow IT, it's a double-edged sword. It can be a good thing. It can be a bad thing. Companies don't want you going to certain places on their equipment. This is my laptop does not belong to me. I can't just go out and visit whatever site I want. And in doing that, the shadow IT is not a bad thing. I mean, I would much rather know that when I come in here in the morning and turn this thing on, that it's going to work properly and it's not going to be broken because of some website that I visited. I didn't get a token that a bad guy planted on a website. And now I can't get to, you know, my self-evaluation. I just brought that up because they're due.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, at the end of the day, people are always going to kind of, there's no accounting for peeps, you know, personal psychology, I guess is what I would kind of come down to. And I've said this so many times on the show, people have said this so many times on the show, so much of security is just kind of dealing with that psychology and just enabling people to make the best decisions in the situations that they're in. So let's move on to our next story then. 200 companies breached in the Gainsight attack. Hackers compromised the customer support platform Gainsight to get access to Salesforce data through connected apps. Now, for me, the most interesting part of this particular attack is that the threat actors first got into Gainsight through that SalesLoft breach back in August, if folks remember that. So if you recall, you know, the SalesLoft breach involved hackers stealing some authentication tokens from the Drift chatbot and then using those to get into some connected Salesforce instances. Now, according to the hackers themselves, they initially breached Gainsight during this attack. And then they use that access to move laterally into Gainsight's customers' Salesforce instances a few months later. And the most striking thing for me off the bat is that long tail of this breach, right? We're talking about fallout from an attack that happened a few months ago, which seems like a complicated timeline to kind of deal with. Michelle, any thoughts on your end about what this kind of, you know, how this timeline looks, how it complicates things for defenders? What's your take here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's sort of a warning to when these types of events happen to sort of anticipate or expect a bit of a fallout and to be on guard and vigilant with this type of attack or compromise. It's just another fallout from targeting this type of ecosystem, right? Where we now again have the proverbial domino effect across all of these organizations.
Yeah, it's that ecosystem situation again, right? And it's kind of why I wanted to include that here, because it's yet another example of like that software supply chain being kind of vulnerable and it being hard to get some visibility into that. And speaking of visibility, you know, Brian, do you have any thoughts on how organizations can kind of, I don't know, maybe gain some more insight into all these moving parts going on in their software supply chains? Or is it just kind of, I don't know, wait until something happens? Any takes there?
I was reading a bit about like the tokens and that were affected in this attack or that were used and their like the persistent permissions. I'm not really sure if that's something that you need for all of these, that maybe that could be a huge issue because with those persistent permissions, that's just giving attackers the chance or the opportunity to go in there and exploit those. But I guess that's the only thing I have on that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, right? Because I do think one of the important stories here is like this kind of, you know, system-to-system trust that we have sort of, you know, inherently. It's like, hey, you know, we trust the SaaS vendor, so we trust them to have this kind of persistent access, not necessarily thinking about what that access could do if it falls into the wrong hands, right? Dave, how about you? I want to bring you into the conversation. Any thoughts on this Gainsight attack, on the SalesLoft breach? What's your take here?
Any time that you have a breach, you're going to have to sit back. You're going to have to evaluate where the breach came from, and you're going to have to evaluate what that breach is going to touch. And you really do need to be in the mindset that it's going to touch everything, because chances are it is. So if you're hosting Gainsight, Salesloft, Salesforce, Gemini, Google, any of the big software chains, it's going to be touched. So you have to go through and you've got to work with all of those companies that you partner with to make sure that their software is secure, and let them know, hey, we've been breached. That means you could possibly be breached. And unless someone completely rebuilds their network and their software connections, that's always going to be a problem.
Absolutely. So it calls for like a more collaborative approach almost. Absolutely. To this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In terms of practicalities, I mean, I don't know. Is there any way to foster more of that collaboration? Do we see enough of it right now? You know, I'm just going to kind of go around, I think, the circle here and see what our thoughts are in terms of the state of this, you know, inter-organizational, inter-platform collaboration. Michelle, I'll start with you. Do you think things are on the right footing for this stuff right now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we could always do better. There's definitely a lot of organizations and certs and ISACs and opportunities to share information where we can all benefit from. I think it's also a issue of having the right curated threat intelligence and knowing what to focus on, because there's so much out there, and something that may not seem as a big issue could be a major issue for your organization based on your attack surface. So I think you can't put out all of the fires, especially the ones that aren't near your house, but you should definitely focus on the ones that are really close to your house, like next door.
Yeah, it's a fine line, right? It's like these things, you know, the attacks can ramify in very interesting ways you can't expect, but you still need to like pay attention. You can't just assume that every single one's going to hit you, right? And so, I don't know, it's a delicate balance. Brian, your take, any thoughts there?
To go along with what Michelle said, just taking these threats seriously, I think that sometimes when organizations are willing to share their information, other organizations don't take it seriously. I mean, for example, if you tell your next door neighbor that, hey, you don't have a front door, your door's missing, and they don't do anything about it and they get robbed, I mean, I think that's a frustrating thing in the world of security. I feel like Dave and Michelle will both agree to that. You need to take these things seriously when they arise. And like Dave said, do your due diligence and look at each and every part of your organization, because like he said, chances are it is affected.
Fantastic. Then let's move on to our next story. The Android streaming devices that hijack home bandwidth for the bad guys. Now, security researcher Brian Krebs broke down the nefarious network of superboxes and other cheap IoT streaming devices, all for sale in legitimate stores and websites that secretly conscript consumers' internet connections for malicious activity. So at a high level, the scheme kind of works like this. The devices promise to let people stream various platforms for free, and they make good on that subscription through some very sketchy apps. But the deal that you're making that you may not know as a consumer is these on the back end, these boxes are also using your home internet connection as bandwidth for a proxy network that helps funnel traffic for botnets, shady content scrapers, and all kinds of malicious activity. Now, you know, most of our listeners are enterprise security folks, and we often touch on enterprise security topics. So to start off this little story, I'm wondering, is there an enterprise angle to this risk, or is this purely a consumer safety issue? And I'm going to start with you, Brian. Do you think this is something organizations need to be worried about, or is it just, hey, consumers, watch what you're doing?
Maybe a little bit of a, I mean, I think everybody can take a lesson from this. To me, it's like if it's something that seems too good to be true, unfortunately, it probably is in this case. I would say both consumers and enterprise.
Absolutely. And I'm also kind of thinking about, you know, we were talking before about shadow IT, and it's very easy for me to see, I don't know, somebody plugging this thing into the wrong network, or, you know, I don't know, maybe you've got your company laptop on the same network as this thing, and who knows what it's going to do, you know? So I think there's opportunity here to ramify.
That's a great point. I feel like that's very much the case when users have something like this at home. They're taking the work home. Now, a lot of us work from home at least a few days a week. So chances are, yes, if you have one at home, it's on the same network.
Yeah. Side note, I've said the word ramify like 12 times in this episode. Why do I keep saying that word? Okay. Now, one of the very interesting things to me about these devices is that they totally sidestep the kind of dark web distribution we're used to for a lot of malware, right? You know, they're promoted by influencers on social media sites, not big name influencers, but influencers still on you know, clear web social media sites. And they're sold on legitimate retail websites. Now, the retailers are rarely selling these things directly, right? It's often third parties using their platform, but they're still there, right? And you have a sort of element of trust in these things. And I'm thinking about how one of the most common tips we give people to avoid being scammed is only shop in legitimate stores. Well, what happens when you're shopping in a legitimate store and you buy one of these things? Michelle, any thoughts on how this complicates our defenses, our anti-phishing techniques, if you will?
Yes, absolutely. So when I saw this article, I immediately sent it to my family because 'tis the season, right? Everybody's going to go out and they're going to be shopping, and there's so many scams out there. So it's never too early to be warning them that, about that. So exactly, I was thinking the same thing, right? You have these trusted vendors, whether it's brick and mortar or online, but they're selling these products that shouldn't be trusted. But it's not too far of a leap to go from trusted vendor to trusted product. But we see this across all types of industries. So, you know, pharmaceutical, food industry. If you go into your favorite supermarket and you buy something, it could be expired. You might go into your favorite restaurant. There could be, you know, food that gives you food poisoning. But, you know, these are trusted providers across many different industries. But, you know, a similar concept with this box that could be sold at your favorite store, online or otherwise, and they're not to be trusted. So again, it comes back to awareness.
Absolutely. Dave, your take on this whole scheme, any thoughts?
I would never buy one of these, not to say that there may be one in the living room. I don't know. But seriously, I don't know how many people have gone to Amazon and actually looked at sold by. Everyone thinks that when they go to Amazon, they're buying it from Amazon. That's not necessarily the case, like you were alluding to earlier. Best Buy does the same thing. You can go onto the Best Buy website and you can buy something that's actually not sold in the store. So the trust, be very wary about trusting Amazon when it's sold by someone else. Amazon's just a distribution platform for them. As far as having it on your network with your work machine, I mean, yeah, you probably shouldn't do that. But if you do, what's anyone actually going to do about that? Is IBM going to call me and say, hey, we noticed you have a Superbox on your network? The first question that's going to come out of my mouth is, what are you doing scanning my network? The trust has to be there, and it's you can't go by where something's purchased from to gain the trust. Yeah, these boxes really don't have a place in the home. And I understand why people get them. They can't afford Netflix. Well, Netflix is $7.99. Cough up the $8. Don't go buy one of these super boxes. You really are putting yourself, your network, your family at risk by doing this, because you're opening up this gigantic door that someone doesn't even have to, you know, you don't have to be, you know, 4'9" to walk through it. You can walk through it as a 7-foot-tall giant. It's there. And so don't do that. That's my answer to that. Don't do that. It's what I used to tell my kids. Well, that burns. Well, then don't do that.
You heard it here, folks. Just don't do it. But I'm glad you brought up that buzzword trust, right? It's been in like all of our conversations today, and it's like the through line, right? How like at the end of the day, you can't really use something like, you know, what's the name of the website as a proxy for trust, or like, or what who developed the thing, right? Like, you have to do your due diligence as the individual, whether you're a developer, consumer, or whoever. You got to make sure the stuff that you're buying, plugging in, it is safe. And you know, that can be tough, but just, you can't just rely on it being Amazon. How would the organization even know that this thing is on your network? And that raises the question for me of like, is there really, there's nothing that an organization can kind of do, right? Like short of surveilling people, I'm probably getting into territory that's going to get this part cut, but I just need to ask the question, you know, is it just kind of like, hey, you know, tell your workers not to buy these kinds of things and then just cross your fingers and hope that they don't? Is that the extent of our defenses here?
It's about the only thing you can do. You can't stop Joe Public from buying one of these or Joe IBM from buying one of these and putting it on their network. You can say, don't buy one of these. It's dangerous to the network or it might be dangerous to our machinery. But in the end, I'm paying for my internet access. I'm paying for my network access. If something happens to an IBM product, the machine that I'm using, okay, then maybe I should be held responsible for that. But as far as putting it on my network, I don't really see a case where any company would be able to say, don't do that, or you can't do that, I should say.
Absolutely. Brian, I saw you nodding. Do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, exactly what Dave said. You can tell people not to do something, but at the end of the day, it's their prerogative. They pay for their Wi-Fi. They pay for their power. If they want to connect something in their home and be at risk, then that's up to them. I will touch on what Dave said about, you know, just going out and purchasing Netflix. I think what makes these things so attractive in today's world is that you can't just have Netflix anymore. You have to have HBO and you have to have Hulu and Disney and you have to have Amazon and you have to have Paramount. And I feel like the list keeps getting longer and longer every time I want to watch a show. Sometimes I feel like halfway through a season, I have to switch to another streaming service. It seems to be getting a little ridiculous. So paying one price to have access to everything is awesome. But I feel like we also need to use that, I don't know, just your gut instinct. Like Michelle was saying, like you can go off to the store and purchase something. But if it looks bad or maybe seems like it's expired and you don't feel great about putting it in your cart, just don't do it. I read that you have to rip out the Google Play Store to get this to work. That should probably be like, huh, maybe at least get you thinking that this might not be the best idea. But honestly, I do see the attractiveness in this and like the desire to want one of these. I actually recently thought about like, oh, could I build one myself that's a little bit safer? Like, because I mean, it is, it's awesome. Like who would not want to have access to this?
That's part of what makes it such a good scam though, right? Like it promises to address like a real pain point that people have. We've all been there, man. We've all been like, how do they reinvented cable? But like, it claims to address a real pain point. It just does so in a really shady, sketchy way. And you know, I'm glad that, you know, you both brought up this fact that like, I think sometimes you have a tendency to feel like in the name of security, we have to kind of go a little further than we really should in terms of what we tell people to do or what we allow them to do. But at the end of the day, you have to recognize that there's a separation and that, you know, people are people and what they do in their, you know, on their home networks, you don't have a right as an organization to touch on that. Zooming out, though, I want to talk a little bit about what this says about the kind of state of IoT security, because I feel like for as long as I've been around, people have been saying IoT security is terrible and it's still terrible. Why? Michelle, any thoughts on why IoT security just can't seem to catch up to everything else?
Yeah, because I think a lot of them are in the hands of just everyday people, all of those devices that are just open to the internet, that are just food for botnets. Yeah, we've been tracking that for a long time, and I don't know. But, you know, it kind of likens to this previous story about the box. I think there is something to be said about individuals taking ownership of their own personal security that then has an impact in what they do in their workplace. So if they're taking ownership of that and doing, you know, what is best for themselves personally and their own home environment, then that would, I would imagine, have some sort of positive impact on what they do in the workplace, because it's all about kind of just thinking about it, right? Just taking a minute to just stop and think about it. Is this the right decision? Am I making the right choice? And I know that's difficult to do because you have to apply that to so many things in your life. Now you have to do it, you know, as it relates to cybersecurity, but I do think there could be an impact there if you just stop and think, is this going to impact me in some negative way? And I'll just say real quick that I had a conversation with a friend over the weekend where her family members had experienced some fraud, and it kind of led back to not having MFA enabled. And it's like, that is something we've talked about so much, right? And now they know. I'm sure MFA is now enabled across everything that can possibly have MFA, but they had to experience that compromise first to know that. But wouldn't it be great if they did it?
Absolutely. And yeah, ever since we've started this podcast, actually even before that, ever since I got into the security world, I just yell at all of my friends and family to make sure they have many factors of authentication. But I like that. That's a nice positive kind of end to this. This segment, you know, if people kind of take some, you know, practice security in their personal lives in good ways, that shows up elsewhere, right? And that can have those, you know, effects on your corporate security too.
I do not own one of those, by the way.
No, Dave, we know that you of all people would never, ever do anything sketchy in any way, shape, or form. You're an upstanding gentleman. Yes. Moving on to our last story of the day. Malicious poems break AI guardrails. Now, I saw this and I had to put it on the show because, as people probably do not know, outside of my day job as a podcaster, I am a poet. And so the one time I'm allowed to talk about poetry on this podcast, I will do it. In a paper titled Adversarial Poetry as a Universal Single-Turn Jailbreak Mechanism in Large Language Models, researchers from DEXI, Sapienza University of Rome, and Santana School of Advanced Studies share that phrasing malicious prompts as poems instead of direct instructions is a remarkably effective way to break guardrails on 25 different models, including all the big ones, your Geminis, Groks, your ChatGPTs, Anthropic, DeepSeek. They all kind of fell for this thing. The researchers' original poems, you know, when they wrote like a malicious poems with their own two hands, achieved an overall attack success rate of 62%. And if they took some prose malicious prompts and fed them to machines and had them turned into poems, they still had a success rate of 43%, which is pretty high. So I just want to start with initial takes from people. What do you think about using poems to break the AI systems? Dave, let's start with you. Any thoughts here?
I am always looking for a way to break the guardrails on AI, not because I want to do anything malicious, but because I want to see what, you know, test the security of the AI that I'm using. Gemini, 100% success rate when using this prose. ChatGPT, 0 to 10%. Which one am I going to trust more? I'm going to go with ChatGPT if it's something that I need to establish trust with. I think it's brilliant to use poetry to get this guardrail off of these things. I really don't want to see it in the AI that I'm using. So, you know, I'm going to lean more towards the ones that are more secure. And if I want to try it myself, I'll write a poem and stick it in Gemini.
Brian, I want to get your take. Any thoughts here on your end?
Yeah, I honestly think that this is like setting up for the great backdrop for a movie where a special team needs to acquire like the best poet in the future when AI is taken over for them to accomplish their mission. Exactly. Dave's already on it. On a serious note, I think it's just interesting how people are constantly finding new ways to jailbreak these AI systems, these LLMs. I don't know where I read it before, but somebody said or told me that it's like it's more of an art when dealing with these and when trying to jailbreak them, especially when new models come out, because one that was better defended against a prompt like this now with the new model might not be so because of reasons that people aren't sure of. But like Dave, I'm always trying to find new ways to jailbreak these as well before I start using one that I want to, want to choose as my daily driver. I'm always trying to jailbreak these in different ways. So super interesting.
Absolutely. Michelle, let's bring you in here. Any thoughts on this tactic?
Yeah, I mean, obviously very creative, right? So we can throw poems at it. We can throw maybe rap songs, other genre of music. creative language. Yeah, let's keep doing that. I think as Dave and Brian both said, we need to make sure that we're training and leveraging models that are that can't get jailbreak. So the only way to do that is to jailbreak it, right? To continue to improve upon the models and the versions.
Trust but verify.
Trust but verify. Ooh, that's good. And you know what? That's a perfect way to end the episode because that is all the time we have for today. I want to thank our panelists, Michelle and Dave and Brian, and thank the viewers and the listeners, of course. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there and don't let anyone tell you that poetry degree was useless. You finally have a reason for it. Now, a sneak peek of our latest Security Intelligence audio-only bonus episode, Trawling the Honey Pot, what it's like to discover a new malware strain. They call it a honeypot, a fake computer system set up to attract cyber criminals just like bees to honey. The purpose is twofold. First, if they're busy attacking a dummy system, they won't be attacking your real assets.
Come, kids. Come inside.
Second, while they're poking around in your digital terrarium, you can watch them, learn from them, see what they're up to in a safe, controlled environment. I understand where the name comes from, honeypot, as in something enticing. But to me, they look more like Superfund sites, pits into which all the web's toxic sludge flows, grease traps more than honey traps. But if you've got the guts to dig through that sludge, you can find things, valuable things, things that help security pros and everyday people protect themselves from that poison. I'd say diamonds in the rough if we weren't actually talking about malware.
Okay. So, hi, I'm Raymond Joseph Alfonso. I am a malware reverse engineer for IBM X-Force Threat Intelligence team.
Raymond is one of those people with guts. As a malware reverse engineer, he spends a lot of time working directly with some very dangerous code.
Malware analysis is really exciting because you don't really know what you're going to get this time. And I also find it kind of fulfilling because sometimes I'm also learning new things. The only downside that I can think of is sometimes it gets real stressful, you know.
Raymond is in the malware pit every day, by which I mean a fake inbox meant to solicit phishing emails and assorted other evils. It was there, not too long ago, that one junk email caught his eye.
When I was doing my research, I saw this one email. I decided to investigate it further, and then I saw that it was delivering different payloads every time.
Quirky Loader. That's what this thing came to be known as. Raymond still can't say for sure why this particular email stood out. As far as spam goes, it was fairly nondescript. But, I don't know, call it his spidey sense. Something triggered an alarm. So he started to dig in. And what he found was far from nondescript. A malware loader combining both tried and true tactics and some new tricks for evading detection.
As they always say, cybersecurity is a cat and mouse game. And I think it will always be like that until the end of time. So we should always try to stay on top of the current malware trends in order for us to effectively protect others from those threats.
Listen to the full episode wherever podcasts are found.